The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 16th, 2016 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump challenges China over Taiwan. What happened? President-elect Donald Trump made a striking break from U.S. diplomatic policy on China by directly accepting a congratulatory call from Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen last week, triggering an indignant response from Beijing. The call was the first between leaders of the two countries since 1979, when the U.S. adopted its One China policy, cut off diplomatic ties with the breakaway island state, and formally recognized Beijing as China's only legitimate government. After China protested Trump's call with Tsai, Trump fired off a series of tweets accusing China of heavily taxing U.S. exports, devaluing its currency, and building a massive military complex in the South China Sea. It later emerged that former Republican presidential nominee Bob Dole was paid $140,000 by the Taiwanese government to convince Trump and his aides that the president-elect should accept a call from Tsai. In response, Beijing warned that if Trump damaged U.S.-China relations, he would greatly reduce the chance to achieve the goal of making America great again. The provocative phone call came amid several signals that Trump's approach to diplomacy and foreign policy would be highly unorthodox. In a call with Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, the president-elect warmly praised Pakistanis as one of the most intelligent people and pledged to address and find solutions to the country's problems, comments that raised consternation in India, Pakistan's longtime adversary. In a separate conversation with Philippines leader Rodrigo Duterte, a controversial figure who once denounced President Obama as the son of a whore, Trump praised his counterpart's bloody street assassinations of drug dealers as the right way to deal with the problem. What the editorial said. Trump's phone call with Tsai shows why he won the election, said the Washington Examiner. As his supporters would tell you, he tells it like it is. And it's refreshing to see a U.S. leader standing up to Beijing. Trump pointed out that it's absurd the U.S. has pledged to defend Taiwan and sold the island nation $1.8 billion worth of arms last year, while our two presidents aren't allowed to speak. Some diplomatic niceties deserve smashing. Trump's decision to push back against the regime of Xi Jinping has merit, said the Washington Post, but insulting tweets are a dangerous way to deal with China. Is Trump planning to plunge the U.S. into a damaging trade war? To aggressively challenge China's extensive military buildup in the South China Sea? Vague threats can lead to misinterpretation and escalation. The president-elect's entire approach to foreign policy appears to be slapdash. He hasn't been receiving State Department intelligence briefings and seems to tell foreign leaders whatever pops into his head. What the columnist said. This was Trump's first foreign policy test, said David Ignatius, also in the Washington Post, and he flunked it. If his unprovoked insults cause China to lose face, Beijing will inevitably respond with countermeasures. This whole affair shows that Trump is vulnerable to being flattered by foreign leaders like Tsai and reacts to criticism with the peak of an American Kim Jong-un. Those traits could be seriously dangerous to global health. Spare us the apocalyptic hyperbole, said Stephen Hayes in the weeklystandard.com. Trump is being criticized for acknowledging that the democratically elected leader of a key trading partner. Yet when President Obama embraced the tyrannical regimes in Cuba and Iran, he received fawning coverage. Besides, Trump's foreign policy may not prove to be as radical as many seem to assume, said Philip Gordon in Politico.com. He has no core convictions and no qualms about completely reversing a policy position. What drives Trump is a deep-seated need for public approval, and that feeling may deter him from making any truly risky decisions. Perhaps, said Ed Kilgore in nymag.com, but events often force a president's hand. George W. Bush promised a more restrained attitude towards the use of military force until 9/11. If Trump is faced with a similarly game-changing event, such as an act of terrorism or confrontation with Iran, North Korea, or China, what direction will his hawkish advisors push him in? The truth is, if the U.S. is attacked or threatened, or perhaps even disrespected, we simply have no idea how he'll react. And a second main story. Pipeline protesters win temporary victory at Standing Rock. What happened? Native Americans and environmental activists won a symbolic victory this week in their battle to stop an oil pipeline from being built near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota, after the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied permission for a section of the project to be constructed under the Missouri River. Protesters, including veterans and celebrities, had flocked to Standing Rock to demonstrate against the Dakota Access Pipeline, which tribe leaders say threatens the reservation's water supply and sacred burial sites. The pipeline, which would transport North Dakota oil 1,200 miles to a terminal in Illinois, is 92% complete. Part of the uncompleted section would have passed under Lake Oaha, a core reservoir a half mile from Standing Rock. But in a surprise announcement, the Corps said it wouldn't grant an easement for Lake Oaha and would instead explore alternate routes. As news spread at the protest camp, drumming and dancing broke out, and people shouted, "Muni Wikoni," Lakota for "water is life." Energy Transfer Partners, the Dallas-based company behind the pipeline, asked a federal judge for a permit to finish the project, while industry leaders called on President-elect Donald Trump to reverse the Corps' decision after his inauguration. The president-elect, who until recently held shares in Energy Transfer Partners, supports the pipeline's original route, said a Trump spokesman, but wouldn't make a final decision until he was in office. Many protesters vowed to remain at the site through the bitter North Dakota winter. "I plan on staying until it's over," said activist Andy Schutte. What the columnist said. "Activism works," said Charles Pierce in Esquire.com. "That's the lesson of Standing Rock, where protesters erected a mini-city of yurts and teepees and braved over-aggressive policing to protect an indigenous people's basic right to clean water. Their passionate stand captured the attention of the nation, and with the Obama administration's help, secured a major victory for a cause once deemed to be hopeless." The Dakota Pipeline has become a meaningless hate totem for the left, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Developers have already made 140 adjustments to the pipeline's route to avoid sensitive sites, and the proposed Lake Oaha crossing is hardly virgin territory. Other oil and gas pipelines cross the Missouri River in at least a dozen places nearby. Yet the Obama administration still caved to the protesters' absurd demands and leaned on the Corps. Fortunately for the energy industry, the incoming Trump administration will have a more rational attitude toward pipelines. That's why Energy Transfer Partners is confident the Corps' decision is just a temporary holdup, said Daniel Gross in Slate.com. In theory, the Corps' refusal to grant an easement should trigger a lengthy environmental review. But Republicans believe they can either pass a law in Congress clearing the way for the pipeline, or that Trump, who championed fossil fuel production in the campaign, will happily exert pressure on agencies and civil servants to make policies that benefit energy firms. The pipeline is dead. Long live the pipeline. Our controversy of the week, Trump's carrier deal. Good news for American workers? So this is what a dealmaker in chief looks like, said Tim Logan in the Boston Globe. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump repeatedly denounced the Carrier Air Conditioner Corporation of Indiana for planning to shift production to Mexico and fire 1,400 workers, and vowed to block the move if he were elected. It seems that he never meant it. Last week, the president-elect flew to Indiana and told cheering workers that Carrier's parent company, United Technologies, had been persuaded to keep the plant open, saving about 800 jobs. United Technologies will reportedly receive some $7 million in tax breaks from Indiana, where Trump's vice president, Mike Pence, is still governor. And Trump may also have used United's federal defense contracts worth about $5.6 billion as leverage. This is just the beginning, said Michael Goodwin in NYPost.com. Trump this week threatened to slap a 35% tariff on goods imported by American businesses that outsource, and called out another Indiana manufacturing firm, Rexnord, for viciously firing all of its 300 workers ahead of its own planned move to Mexico. Trump, in other words, is already making good on his pledge to save U.S. jobs even before he's taken office. Imagine what he can do when he's actually president. As an actual conservative, I'm horrified, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. Republicans supposedly believe in free markets and abhor crony capitalism, and the government picking winners and losers in the marketplace. Yet here we have a Republican president-elect using threats and bribes of taxpayers' money to make a private company bend to his own need to look like a savior. Trump's shakedown of Carrier may have won him a short-term political victory, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But this kind of bullying will only force companies to make investments based on politics, not economics. Who should decide where and how companies make their products? The companies. Or a branding executive turned politician who wants to claim political credit. Besides, the Carrier deal doesn't address the underlying forces that are eroding blue-collar jobs, said Ben Castleman in 538.com. The disappearance of millions of U.S. manufacturing jobs since 1980 has far more to do with advances in automation than with offshoring. In a modern factory, 200 workers can produce as much as 2,000 could a half century ago. Trump's approach could very well backfire, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. Companies who weren't previously considering moving production overseas may now threaten to do so, hoping for a Carrier-style bribe to make them stay. Trump's ominous warnings of consequences for outsourcers, meanwhile, may scare away firms thinking of opening new factories in the U.S. because they don't want to feel locked down. Give Trump some credit, said Peggy Noonan in WSJ.com. He can't intervene every time a company plans to offshore jobs. But once in a while, it doesn't hurt for a president to show a little muscle and remind the business world of its obligations to the national good. Still, let's put the 800 jobs Trump saved in perspective, said Julia Turner in Slate.com. President Obama's bailout of the U.S. auto industry saved 1 million jobs. During his presidency, 805,000 manufacturing jobs were created. The real danger is that our new president, the former host of The Apprentice, will focus on crowd-pleasing gimmicks and eschew the patient, unglamorous work of creating jobs for a 21st century economy. The carrier deal looks like a troubling blueprint for a government by stunt. Into our good week, bad week shorts. It was a good week for fooling around. After Canadian scientists found that sex helps women build stronger memories. The reward signals generated by sex, the researchers said, can improve neurogenesis, the growth of neurons in the hippocampus, where memories are stored. It was a good week for declaring really early. After Vice President Joe Biden unofficially announced that he's running for president 1 month after the last election. "I'm going to run in 2020, Biden, 74, told reporters. What the hell, man? And it was a good week for spreading cheer. After the Mall of America in Minneapolis added its first African-American Santa Claus. "This is a long time coming," said Landon Luther, co-owner of the Santa Experience. "We want Santa to be for everyone, period." But it was a bad week for Chris Christie. After a Quinnipiac University poll found that just 19% of New Jersey voters approved of the governor's job performance, the lowest score for any governor in the poll's 20-year history. "How the mighty have fallen," said poll director Maurice Carroll. It was a bad week for fake news. After Pope Francis said spreading false, scandalous stories was a sin and likened it to the sickness of coprophilia, a fascination with excrement. And it was a bad week for leading by example. After a national study revealed that parents of kids between ages 8 and 18 spend just as much time, an average of 9 hours and 22 minutes per day, looking at smartphones, TVs, and other digital devices as their children do. "That's not being a good role model," said the study sponsor. Title on the briefing page this week is Securing the Border. President-elect Trump has promised to build an impenetrable wall along the U.S.-Mexican border. Is it needed? How is the border protected now? About one-third of the 1,954-mile southern border has been fenced and walled off to keep out drug smugglers and illegal immigrants. A few dozen miles of 10-foot-high corrugated iron fencing went up in the 1990s, but most of the barrier was erected following the passage of the 2006 Secure Fence Act, a response to a massive surge in illegal immigration from Mexico. These newer sections of the wall, concrete, 10 to 20 feet high, and often topped with razor wire, are mainly concentrated in border cities like San Diego, where illegal immigrants can easily disappear into the urban sprawl. About 1,300 miles of the border, which spans California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, are either open or blocked by a single barbed wire fence that can be quickly snipped through with a pair of $10 bolt cutters. These wall-free stretches, which are mostly in mountainous or desert areas, aren't entirely unprotected. Some 21,000 Border Patrol agents guard the entire border and use motion sensors, drones, and other high-tech equipment to detect intruders. Yet hundreds of immigrants still slip through every day. When you secure one area, says Sean Moran, vice president of the Border Patrol Agents Union, you push traffic to another. How many people cross successfully? An estimated 170,000 people eluded capture while crossing the border last year. Roughly 46% of all those who attempted the journey, according to a leaked Department of Homeland Security report. That's down from 1.7 million people in 2005, when 64% escaped capture. The demographics of border crossers have changed dramatically in that time. A decade ago, almost all of those apprehended were Mexican, but most now caught are trying to escape horrific drug gang violence and social chaos in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Many Central Americans hand themselves in as soon as they cross the border and request asylum and wind up in holding centers for months. We've turned into a detention agency, said Chris Cabrera, a Border Patrol agent. We're doing jailer work and sometimes babysitting. With holding centers full, migrants are often given a court date and released. Many never show up and become part of the U.S.'s illegal immigrant population of more than 11 million people. Why are fewer people crossing? Additional border security has had an effect. The cartels that control most illegal entry routes from Mexico to the U.S. used to charge $1,500 per crossing. Now that journey is more difficult, they demand $6,000, too much for many would-be immigrants. The threat of federal prosecution is another key deterrent. In the early 1990s, the federal government prosecuted fewer than 4,000 people a year for reentering the U.S. after being deported. Last year, the Obama administration charged 70,000 people. Changing social and economic conditions in Mexico have also had an impact. What's happened in Mexico? A big drop in the birth rate from 7 children per woman in the 1960s to 2.2 today has reduced the pool of potential migrants. And the U.S. slow recovery from the Great Recession, coupled with a strong economy in Mexico, has decreased the incentive for Mexicans to head north. In fact, more Mexican nationals are now leaving the U.S. than are entering the country. We haven't seen that since the 1930s, said Ana Gonzalez Barrera of the Pew Research Center. It's always possible, of course, that migration could resume at some point. What is Trump's plan? The president-elect has backed off his vow to wall off the entire border and recently spoke of building a 30 to 55 foot high precast concrete wall across 1,000 miles of the border. He said the rest of the border is essentially impassable because of the mountains and vicious rivers. Trump estimates that the bill would be about $10 billion. But that seems optimistic given that the border's existing 650 miles of wall cost $7 billion. Independent estimates suggest Trump's higher wall would cost $25 billion. Many experts believe that expanding the wall in remote areas wouldn't deter determined border crossers. If you build a 20-foot fence, says Moran, the union official, they build a 21-foot ladder. Are there alternatives to the wall? Border Patrol officials want 23 miles of extra wall to cover known crossing points and a massive increase in funding for the virtual wall, the drones, cameras, and sensors that agents use to automatically locate and track intruders. President George W. Bush approved a border-length virtual wall in 2006, but the system was hopelessly ineffective. In windy conditions, it mistook trees for people. The project was shelved in 2011 after $1 billion had already been spent. Some experts think that rather than focusing on border crossers, the government should crack down on people who overstay their visas, a group that accounts for 40% of the U.S. illegal immigrant population. In the short term, Trump's election victory is expected to cause a spike in attempted illegal border crossings. If you talk to recent arrivals, they all know about President Trump. They all know about a wall, said Jim Darling, mayor of McAllen, Texas. The message, he says, is clear. You better get over here before January and the swearing-in ceremony. Moving into the best columns, we'll take two from the U.S. The first, Clinton's campaign is at fault. Hillary Clinton blew an election against the weakest major party candidate in American history, said Damon Linker, and she and her campaign should stop blaming others for their loss. The Clinton camp has pointed fingers at millennials, the media, FBI Director James Comey, and the fundamentals of a change election. But Clinton ran against an erratic, historically unpopular candidate who got relentlessly negative media coverage, and she should have won in a landslide. Why didn't she? After a very successful Democratic convention, Clinton took a comfortable lead in the polls. She then attempted to coast to victory on an air of inevitability and an undertow of Trump hatred. For weeks, she did little public campaigning and focused on mocking baskets of deplorables at private fundraisers for wealthy Democrats. She bought an avalanche of negative, condescending ads whose sole message was that Donald Trump is a jerk. Where was the overarching vision for the country and its future? There was none. Instead, Clinton focused on what her election would mean to women and various identity groups and never gave all Americans a reason to vote for her. That's why she lost an election she should have easily won. Enabling an American kleptocracy. There are many countries in the world that are governed by men who use their office to enrich themselves and their families, said Jonathan Chait. Until now, the U.S. has not been one of them. But Donald Trump's vast, largely hidden business operations here and abroad now guarantee that he will make decisions as president that will affect his own personal and family wealth. That would demolish a long American tradition of presidents disclosing and divesting from any financial conflicts. And the Republican Party is happy to oblige. House Oversight Committee Chairman Jason Chaffetz boasted before the election that his committee would engage in years of investigations into possible conflicts posed by the Clinton Foundation, but now dismisses any need to go on fishing trips regarding Trump's financial stake in many businesses here and in at least 20 other countries. Republicans insist that since Americans knew Trump had a family business empire and elected him president anyway, his self-dealing isn't an issue. In other words, Trump is free to turn our nation into a kleptocracy. If Trump can so quickly demolish decades of precedent against presidential self-enrichment, what other norms will he destroy? And an international column, one of the How They See Us columns, titled, Iran Cries Foul at Sanctions Renewal. What an outrageous bait and switch, said Mohammad Kazem Aboulou. The details of the nuclear deal that our government clinched last year with the U.S. and other major world powers were clear. Iran would dismantle many of its nuclear facilities in exchange for the lifting of U.S. and European Union financial sanctions against Iran. When the deal was signed, it was understood by all parties that a separate U.S. sanctions regime, the Iran Sanctions Act of 1996, would not be renewed when it expired at the end of this year. But last week, the U.S. Senate voted unanimously to extend those sanctions, which prohibit investment in all Iranian energy sectors for another decade. The sanctions are not currently in effect because President Obama is allowed to waive them if he believes our government is complying with the deal. But President Trump could falsely claim that we weren't honoring the pact, demand that the sanctions be enforced, and cripple our economy. Is our government prepared to stand up and defend Iran's honor? Once again, the devious Americans have revealed their true nature, said Hossein Shamsian. The reformist government of President Hassan Rouhani naively thought it could trust the U.S. Deluded Iranian officials bleated that the nuclear agreement would solve every problem facing our country. Unemployment, desertification and drought, bad weather, inflation, production stagnation, sanctions, all were to end. As a result, we filled our sole heavy water nuclear reactor with concrete and dismantled most of our uranium-enriching centrifuges. Now we find that the U.S. negotiated the deal in bad faith. The only solution is to pull out of the nuclear pact and return to the correct point where we started. That's exactly what they want us to do, said Sayed Alil Mir Bakeri. The U.S. has certainly violated the spirit of the deal by extending sanctions until 2026, but it has not violated the letter of the pact. By renewing these punitive measures, the U.S. is trying to push Iran to make wrong and emotional decisions to provoke us into pulling out of the nuclear deal. That would give the Americans a pretext to retaliate against us. Rather than step into that trap, Iran should appeal to the other parties to the treaty, particularly France, Germany, and Russia. There is a global consensus that the nuclear deal was a net good for the region. That's why now is the time to strengthen relations with all who are dissatisfied with the United States, said Musa Gadinijad. The majority of the elite and public in European countries do not have a favorable opinion of Donald Trump, and his protectionist trade policies will likely anger China, India, and other nations. We need to mobilize the global consensus against the U.S. For once, America, and not Iran, could find itself isolated. And the last word, titled this week, The Business of Being Santa. This July, hundreds of Santa impersonators gathered in Missouri, said writer Mary Meehan. In between swapping tips on beard care and playing baseball, they learned how to take their Santa gigs to the next level. It's the middle of summer, and the 10-story atrium at the Chateau on the Lake Hotel is filled with Santas. They are slow-moving spots of cotton-topped crimson along the railings of the upper floors. They crowd the glass-walled elevators, rising and falling in rushes of red, white, and green. They are at the bar, by the pool, and in long lines for the buffet. A few are planning to meet later for milk and cookies near the spa. Outside in 90-degree temperatures, Santas compete in tug-of-war and foot races. At night, they dance in their Santa casual cocktail outfits on a twilight steamboat cruise. And everywhere, there's the sound of jingles, not short, hard rings that might signal a passing sleigh, but the slow, rolling sound of bells on the shoes of old men walking carefully and heavily. The average age of a Mr. Claus at Discover Santa 2016 is 62.5. Billed as the world's largest Santa convention, the five-day celebration and trade show has drawn 750 Santa Claus impersonators from all over the United States to Branson, Missouri, a town in the Ozark Mountains that's essentially like Las Vegas, but with country music in place of gambling. Here, between the stifling humidity of southern Missouri and the air conditioning of hotels, the Santas meet with vendors to talk about makeup, beard care, marketing websites, and North Pole workshop sets. Anything that can make them the best Santas possible. Because the life of a professional Santa isn't easy, and it doesn't come cheap. The professional Santa industry is growing to outfit a larger, more organized community of aging baby boomers who are linked by the internet and tasked with delivering increasingly cutting-edge performances. At Discover Santa, attendees are given an agenda book that reads like a Santa Sky Mall, packed with gear that includes the Santa Oath belt buckle, $55, a service that makes websites for practicing Santas, $369 and up, and Planet Santa cooling vests, $199 on sale. Most of these guys are never going to get back what they spend, said Santa Mike Pulati while watching a fashion show at the convention. A basic quality Santa suit can run $600. Pulati, a retired Texas high school coach who only does charity events, counts himself among those who won't see a return on their Yuletide investments. But he says there's a magic moment when a kid looks at him and really sees the myth turned man. And that instant of innocence and awe is incentive enough for Pulati to stick with the seasonal job. For some of the attendees, being Santa is an encore to a successful career in another field. One Santa I met was a retired Navy pilot. Another was an active Catholic priest. Others have aged into the role. After all, there is really only one job for which white-haired, chubby, bearded, older white men, 99% of the Santas at the convention are white, are uniquely qualified. For others, like my brother Pat, it runs in the family. Our grandfather, Howard Meehan, was a professional Santa in the 1940s at North Pole, Colorado, a Christmas-themed amusement park. Pat himself has spent 34 years in the suit and has held the Santa job at an upscale mall in Louisville for the past 25 years. Pat loves kids. Outside of being Saint Nick, he volunteers hundreds of hours a year at schools and the local library. But at 63, the grueling business of being a mall Santa gets a little tougher every year, and the crowds get rowdier. A few years ago, another mall Santa working across town got punched by an impatient parent after taking a bathroom break. Pat and his wife, Elizabeth, both retired court clerks, spent $3,000 to make it to Branson this year. And it wasn't spent lightly. For Pat, it's an investment. He's here to learn how to go beyond being a mall Santa and score advertising contracts, corporate parties, and in-home celebrations. He wants to go big time. Discover Santa 2016 offers 42 workshops to help with this. Some are basic, like a more comfortable hat for Santa, or a makeup tutorial called Lights, Camera, Action. Some are practical, including Santa and Special Needs Children, or Santa Ethics 101. Many of the workshops focus on the ins and outs of the business of freelance performing, finding and keeping clients, international Santa gigs, pro-level Santa career business, marketing your Santa services, and Santa schedule organization and planning. Nearly all the Santas in Branson are also real bearded Santas. A trend that began in the 1970s is now the industry standard. Most, like my brother, wear their beards year-round and follow strict rules of conduct when in public. There's even an official Santa oath they follow. I'm chastised one night over dinner because I keep talking about all the Santas. My brother frowns at me from across the table and mouths, "There is a believer," while nodding his head toward a little girl at the next table. "There are a lot of Santa's helpers here," he corrects me in a voice loud enough for her to hear. With a year-long commitment to the act, it's no wonder these Santas have come to Branson to learn how to get more from it. Jim Bethurum from Brighton, Missouri, fell into the Santa life casually after his years working construction left him disabled and depressed. Last year, at age 59, he stopped shaving. And when he finally had the full beard and white hair, people on the street started treating him differently. "It's like going from being a nobody to being a VIP," he says. His first gig as Santa was in the 2015 Branson Christmas Parade. He's invested $1,200 in two Santa suits and has a special fur comb to make sure his collar and cuffs are just so. After the convention, he's going to a weekend retreat put on by SchoolForSantas.com. School for Santas is owned by Tim Conahan, also known as Hollywood Santa. Conahan organized the first Discover Santa 10 years ago and is a master at selling himself as the model Santa whose success can be copied by anyone willing to invest some time and money. As the number of Santas has grown, so has the array of Santa suits and personas to choose from. Conahan said a few decades ago an American Santa had two looks, the religious long-robed St. Nicholas and the Coca-Cola-styled Santa with a cherry red coat and hat. Now, every variation of Santa is a chance to grab a new audience. This year, the Lone Star Santas from Texas came 150 strong to Branson, wearing coordinated outfits that included matching red cowboy hats. At the inadequately named Red Suit Gala, a Civil War Santa wore a blue wool military-style coat with stars on top and striped red and white pants beneath. Steampunk Santa had brass gadgets affixed to a black coachman's hat and light-up shoes. A towering Big Sky Santa was draped in a floor-skimming red western duster topped with a black and white fur capelet and fur-trimmed cowboy hat. And Renaissance Santa sported gold-embroidered burgundy velvet knee breeches and a matching mid-length cape, with an equally elegant Mrs. Claus at his side. Investments like this can pay off. In a workshop on how to be a mall Santa, veteran Kringle Albert Johnson said that at a nice mall like the one my brother works at, a Santa could make $10,000 a season. But there's a trade-off. That kind of money requires 10 to 12-hour shifts almost every day from Thanksgiving through Christmas, a time synonymous with vacation and family time. Being a high-level Santa means working for most of the holiday season you embody. This is especially true of traveling Santas who are contracted through agencies to work in remote or underserved malls. Traveling Santas can end up far from home and unable to even visit on weekends. That's what happened to Doug White, who came to Branson from Atlanta. White had been assigned to a mall in Macon, Georgia, about 90 miles from his home. He lived in a hotel for weeks and gave up on traveling Santa life after one season. "I didn't like going home at night to an empty room," he says. "I didn't like waking up in the morning in an empty bed." White now has a three-day-a-week gig at a historic home in Atlanta. The only traveling he does is to visit disabled children who can't leave their homes. Pat left the convention after making contacts at a few agencies, and he picked up advice on the kind of photos that work best on a website, and new insight into working a Christmas cruise. But he can't lose the nagging feeling that he should be doing more. Although I know mall Santa work is hard, it seems to me that a Santa who gets to go home to his Mrs. Claus every night during the Christmas season has it pretty good. And it's clear that if Pat wants to do something dramatically different and get paid for it, he needs to take his self-promotion to a new level. And, in spite of an oversized persona, Pat and some of the other Santas I met are introverts at heart. They're the ones I prefer. After 5 days in Branson, I've learned that Santas who are too on can be unsettling, especially if you're trapped in an elevator with a dozen of them. Throughout the convention, children would wander in and be told, "The real Santa is here somewhere. You decide who he is." The good Santas follow with a dramatic pause, a slow wink, and a smile. Others raise their hand and squeal, "It's me." The best are like my brother. They let the children approach, and if they do, then Santa leans down, smiles, and simply asks, "Well, how are you today?" And the kids, unafraid and awed, lean in to hug a legend turned real. This was originally published in National Geographic. One of the obituaries for you this week. The Broadway star who became America's mom, Florence Henderson, 1934 to 2016. For a generation of Americans, Florence Henderson was the perfect mother. The blonde and beaming actress played Carol Brady on The Brady Bunch, the unapologetically upbeat sitcom about a cheery widow with three daughters who marries and makes a happy California home with a widower who has three sons. On air from 1969 to 1974, The Brady Bunch was derided by many critics as a saccharine distraction during the Vietnam era. But the show was beloved by its audience as an island of innocence in a jaded time, and has since inspired countless movies, books, plays, satires, and spoofs. Unlike real life, the Brady's problems were always solved in 30 minutes, Henderson said. I think that show had a little magic charm about it. Born in Dale, Indiana, Henderson was the youngest of 10 children. Her father was a sharecropper, and the family struggled financially, said the New York Times. Henderson began working at age 8, sometimes singing a folk or country song in exchange for groceries. At 17, with help from the family of an affluent friend, she moved to New York City to study singing and acting, and within a year she was a chorus member on Broadway. In 1952, composer Richard Rodgers picked her for the lead role of Laurie in a touring production of Oklahoma, said the Washington Post. A year later, she starred in a Broadway revival of the acclaimed musical. More star turns followed in The Sound of Music, South Pacific, and other Broadway hits. Henderson made frequent variety show appearances and in 1962 became the first woman to guest host The Tonight Show. She initially refused to audition for the role of Carol Brady because, as committed New Yorker, she didn't want to move to Los Angeles. But her agent persisted, she won the part, and her slyly sexy chemistry with co-star Robert Reed made the show thrive. Henderson remained a bankable TV star long after The Brady Bunch went off the air, appearing in shows such as The Love Boat, Ally McBeal, 30 Rock, and WWE Raw. In memoirs and interviews, she dished about busy romantic life that belied her wholesome image. I may have more than one friend with benefits, the 82-year-old Henderson said earlier this year. It's very healthy for the heart. On the Talking Points page, Pizzagate, when fake news gets real. Americans just got a glimpse of what it will mean to have a conspiracy theorist in chief, said Olivia Nuzzi in thedailybeast.com. This week, a man opened fire with an AR-15-style assault weapon in the Comet Ping Pong Pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C. Edgar Madison Welch, 28, who thankfully injured no one, said he was self-investigating a popular fake news story known as Pizzagate, which claims that Hillary Clinton ran a child sex ring from the pizza joint's basement. There was absolutely no evidence for the story, yet that didn't stop it from spreading across social media and into Trump's administration. Before the election, incoming National Security Advisor Lieutenant General Michael Flynn posted a tweet linking Clinton to sex crimes with children. Flynn's son, Michael Jr., who has served as his chief aide, recently insisted that until Pizzagate is proven to be false, it'll remain a story. These are the kind of people who will now run our country? Let's not get hysterical, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. Yes, fake news on the internet is toxic to public discussion, but conspiracy theories have existed forever, both on the left and the right. Just ask Dan Rather about those memos. There's no way to prevent quacks from generating sensational stories that gullible people will choose to believe. Credible journalistic outlets repeatedly debunked Pizzagate, but that didn't matter to a nut job like Welch, who, if he hadn't shown up at the doorstep of this restaurant, would have shown up at the gate of Edwards Air Force Base asking about the aliens at Area 51. Yes, conspiracy theories have always existed, said Margaret Sullivan in the Washington Post, but never before have we had a president who gives them his imprimatur. The chief birther appointed Steve Bannon, head of the conspiracy-generating website Breitbart News, as his campaign manager and chief advisor. Now, as he prepares for the presidency, Trump wants to cross another bridge into a world without facts. When a surrogate was asked last week about Trump's baseless claim that millions of immigrants voted illegally, she replied, "There's no such thing anymore as facts." To his supporters, she explained, whatever Trump says is truth, while whatever the media says is a lie. We are crossing over into a truly Orwellian dystopia, said Eric Fraser in the Charlotte Observer. Objective, verifiable facts no longer matter as much as our preconceptions and passions do. Obamacare. Repeal and delay. Having spent the past 6 years promising to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, congressional Republicans have shifted to a new strategy, said Gary Legume in Salon.com. Repeal and delay. Their plan is to pretend to repeal much of Obamacare soon after Donald Trump is sworn in, using a legislative technique that circumvents the Senate Democratics' filibuster power, but delay implementation of those changes for 3 years. Why? Because despite their constant calls for a repeal, Republicans are discovering that making major health care policy is hard, especially when you're trying to re-engineer a program that has provided health coverage to 20 million Americans. That's why Republicans still have not put together a viable replacement plan. Repeal and delay may seem to be a smart political tactic for Republicans, said Philip Klein in the Washington Examiner, but it's doomed to fail. Insurers are already leaving the state health care exchanges in droves. If they know the law is on borrowed time, many more will pull out, sending Obamacare into a rapid death spiral. And while it's true that Republicans would struggle to get an alternative system through the Senate now, it may be even harder after the 2018 midterms. The GOP is making a very cynical calculation, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. To limit political blowback, they don't want to put their own health care alternative into effect until after those midterms. In 2018, with the clock ticking on full repeal, they hope to force Democrats to vote for whatever they've come up with. If Democrats refuse, they'll be accused of allowing a humanitarian catastrophe. If they give in, they'll share some of the blame when people realize the Obamacare replacement either gives them bare-bones coverage or jacks up their cost. The GOP has only itself to blame for this dilemma, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com. Thanks to Republicans' relentless propaganda campaign, the concept of Obamacare is widely disliked. But most of what the law does is extremely popular. Expanding Medicaid, forcing insurers to cover those with pre-existing medical conditions, allowing young people to stay on their parents' policies until age 26. In a recent poll, for example, only 26% of voters favored full repeal. The reality is that it's not possible to keep Obamacare's popular features while eliminating the unpopular requirements that pay for them. When voters get angry about what they've lost, they'll know whom to blame. And that brings us just about time to wrap up the show. So we will end with a quote. This comes from Henry David Thoreau, quoted in lithub.com. Mr. Thoreau says, "A man is rich in proportion to the number of things which he can afford to let alone." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.